Welcome to the GTC podcast.
And then I haven't charged my earbuds.
Yeah, it's a nightmare, isn't it? Like, especially when you're travelling or you're away, you've got your Bluetooth ones, and then you're like, well, if they fail, you know, two is one, one is none, and all that. So you need a plug-in pair as well. I've just hit record, mate. Has that come up and given you a notification?
Something come up, yeah. That's
fine. Sweet. So I think we are recording. If it all goes wrong, we're not recording, and we can figure that out down the line. I'm a constant professional here at GTC Podcast, so wonderful. Awesome. So for you listeners, you've had the intro that is the pre-recorded one, but welcome back to the GTC Podcast. We've had a bit of a layoff with a lot of different things going on, but finally we're sort of starting to get in the swing of it, and we've got some awesome guests lined up, one of which is Mark that we're going to speak to today. I'm not going to steal his thunder. I'm going to let him introduce himself and what he's running at the moment, and then we'll get into the meat and bones of it, and you'll be able to find out more about him as we go. So, Mark, over to you, mate. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, hi, PJ. I'm Mark. I'm one of three that runs Mad Dog Adventures. So we're a small adventure and training business, I suppose. And three best mates that basically started a business just so that we could carry on having adventures while we were supposed to be growing up. So
Perfect. So add a little bit more meat on those bones then. Let's say you say it's an adventure company. So what do you do? Are you focusing on weekends? Do you do more massive expeditions? You know, what sort of field do you lie in?
So we started out with just like the guiding aspect. So a couple of us are qualified mountain leaders, so sort of taking people out on weekend mountain trips, day trips, etc. But we really found our stride. We really enjoy more the teaching aspect, giving people the skills to sort of go off and do it themselves. So the majority of our work is UK based, UK mountains, and a nice like private woodland that we get to use. And then, yeah, we've got like a big international exped out in the jungle, which has been on hold for 2 years, thanks to COVID. And hopefully some more international trips will come on the back of that one. So we've got a few more things sort of rattling around the back of our head.
Yeah, as is always, isn't it? It's the ideas are always the easy part, really.
Yeah, 100%. It's making it a reality that becomes a nightmare.
That's where the challenge is set in. Awesome. So obviously you're one of three, and I'm sure the circle of MDA like expands wider than that anyway. But let's narrow down on yourself. So give us a little background about you, about Mark. Like, how did you get into the outdoor world? How did you get into the teaching aspect and the courses? Like, where does it all stem from?
It probably stems from my one sort of rebellious bit of teenage sort of angst, if you like. I wasn't a rebellious teenager. I wasn't stroppy at all. And I was born in London. So I'm a London boy. I'm a born again country boy now. But growing up, like I used to go like night fishing with my dad. So there was a little bit of outdoors aspect there. But I used to hear him talking about when he was a kid running around the fields. He lived in the countryside as an army cadet, with a Bren gun and, you know, the Enfield rifles and things. And in the back of me, I was like, oh, I want to do that. And my mum and dad at the time said no, because of the IRA threat, you know, so cadet centres were all in TA centres at the time. And you know, that was a bit messier than it is nowadays. And I remember it just like, it's one of the memories of my teenage years. I remember being sat in the back of the car, and they said no, and I just turned around, and I think it was the first time I might have sworn in front of my mum and dad as well. She said, you're bollocks to it then. I'll join the army when I leave school. And the moment I said it, I was like, it's a bloody good idea. That's what I want to do. All right, I think I'll have a bit of that. And they literally, and I was a proper chunky, fat teenager at school. Well, I'd say I was beyond fat. I was probably obese. And they've just let me join army cadets the next week. And they admitted years later, they thought, the fat little git will go to army cadets, he'll get his head kicked in, and that will put him off this silly army idea. And sadly for them, and luckily for me, it didn't.
It really didn't, yeah.
It backfired on them. Tremendous.
Amazing, Amazing. So their idea was to put you off by, no, you can't do that. So, well, if we let you do the sort of entry level version, if you like, you'll get put off and it will never happen. And you'll do what they wanted you to do. Yeah. And then in classic teenage rebellion, it all went wrong and you did end up in the army.
Yeah, 100%. I even, my first weekend away as a young army cadet, it's the only first one I remember. I remember being given a 1937 pattern poncho / ground sheet thing. It wasn't one of those nylon ponchos like the old 58 one. It was a bit of canvas, like in a weird, it's like a cape. I had 58 webbing. I was freezing cold. I didn't sleep at all night. I was tipping it down with rain and no one showed me how to put a shelter up. And I'm just wrapped in this 1930s canvas cape. Absolutely knackered, proper chunky lad. And I think I pretty much nearly got hypothermia that night. And I come home just ruined, but I loved it. And they were like, so I take it you're leaving then, you know, you won't go back. I said, no, I'm going away again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I've booked on another one.
And that was it.
It's mental, isn't it? It's that, I don't know, people don't really understand it and it's really hard to explain to people. But when you're cold, wet and miserable, for me, it's the arrogance and the ego knowing that 99% of the population would not be comfortable in that position. And being comfortable in adversity or comfortable in an uncomfortable situation, whichever way you want to put it, it is addictive, isn't it? You know, yeah, and
definitely that old type 2 fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it was Jason Fox, wasn't it, who sort of made that a little bit more popular, the old type 1, type 2 fun and stuff like that. And we'll probably end up touching on that a little bit more in detail as we go on, so I won't elaborate just now. Awesome. So you joined the army straight out of school, is that right?
Yeah, no, so I did army cadets. My mum put a foot down, was not going to sign the paperwork at 16. She said no. Yeah,
same story, mate.
You can go to college. I didn't want to go to college, you know, I wasn't interested at all. By then I was well and truly, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So no, 18, I went off to Basingbourne. There was an ATR there, so it shows my age, Army Training Regiment. And yeah, joined the Army at 18.
Blimey. And what regiment did you go into? Was it, in those days, was it a matter of choice? Was it, you know, I know it weren't the 1920s where it's like, well, your local regiment is the Gloucestershire Rifles and Troopers. But, you know, at that sort of time, how was it working? Was it, you select where you want to go? Was there a barb test at that sort of time, yeah, or an entry test?
I was talking about that at work the other day, actually. Yeah, I remember doing the barb test and completely messing it up the first time because I think the bloke in the careers officer told me that speed was a factor and there was like a test at the end where you had to guess where this ball that went invisible sort of would land. And since he said it was speed, I thought, well, I'll just keep hitting the screen and just get rid of this. And of course, the thing's built to sort of suss out a learning curve, so the test just went on. And in the end, luckily, the bloke come in and sort of sussed what I was doing. He said, do you want to do that again? I was like, yeah.
Yes, but, please.
But no, yeah, no, you could choose. I mean, I think I've got a mate that's still in and they don't even get really to choose now, don't they? They get like top three out of infantry.
Mm.
I mean, it's different if you want to trade and that sort of thing, but I was going to eat crayons and join the infantry. So, but yeah, no, it, back in those days, you know, you had choices. You still put like a three choices down, particularly, and I'll put it out there because somebody that listens to this that will know me will pick me up on it otherwise. So my first choice, I was obsessed with being a paratrooper. Second was PWRR, which is where I ended up. And I can't even remember what I put as my third. Might have been the Royal Green Jackets because they recruited from London at the time. They don't even exist anymore. So, yeah, and I sort of smashed the running aspect on mid, sort of went off to do like the initial thing for the power reg, and me and pull-ups were just not getting on as a former proper fat kid. so they were like, you know, well, you can come back and have another go at this, or you can go join your local regiment, PWRR. So that's what I did. I didn't want to hang around anymore. I thought, I'm not waiting. I've waited 2 years.
Yeah.
Just go, get on with it and we'll see what happens.
I think that's a surprisingly common situation. You know, I was very similar in terms of like I wanted to join when I was straight out of school, 16. Parents wouldn't sign the paperwork, so I went on and did like 2 years at, well, sixth form for me because I couldn't get into college. And yeah, I think it's quite a common story. And I don't know, what's your opinion on it? Would you change it if you could now? Would you have gone in at 16? Do you think the extra 2 years or almost 2 years of being at college helped you grow up and therefore benefited you when you got to regiment? Or what's your opinion on it now, all these years later?
Now, I'm 100% behind the 16 is too young. You know, if I had a kid that wanted to join the forces and at 16, obviously, I think they've got like a school, haven't they, like a college at Harrogate or whatever. That might be a bit different. But I served with people that had joined as boy soldiers, and they were like brainwashed. Mm. It was because they'd been, you know, yeah, they were army barmy. It was great because they'd got in there so young that they knew nothing else. But I always thought, well, they literally know nothing else. And I had some turn up years later in my career on Herrick 6, sort of about halfway through the tour. We got given some lads that had sort of just turned 18. They'd been at Harrogate, and of course they could come out and join in the fun. And all I remember thinking is, they don't have a clue about what life is before you go and risk it. And I think it's good to have a little bit. I mean, I'm not saying at 18 I had it all down and sorted. But yeah, like, you know, if my daughter wanted to join the forces at 16, I would do anything to sort of put her off. Not necessarily force her into college like I was, but, you know, even if it's go do some volunteering, go travelling, just have 2 years of having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I think you are a bit more grown up.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. Obviously, everything always depends on the person and the individual. Like when I went through training, we had, I think, a couple of guys that were young, very young, 16, 17, and I was like 18 anyway. So I sort of considered myself in that bracket, but I've always been like relatively mature. My mum would disagree, but sort of amongst my peers, maybe a little bit more senior. So I felt like I was ready at 16, but I think, as you say, you never really are. I think I agree with you. Some people would probably be old enough and a bit more mature, but I think it's good to experience outside life before you get fully sucked into the way either the Marines for me or the Army was, because it can be very, as you say, indoctrinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, mate. So you ended up in Princess of Wales Royal Regiment, or is it Prince of Wales?
Princess.
Which is an infantry regiment, arguably, apparently. And how did you find it when you first got there? Obviously, it was your second choice, but I'm sure by the time you sort of got there and got into the swing of it, you got fully sucked into the regiment, and it's got actually a really, really proud history. So I'm sure you sort of fully absorbed that and got settled in. What was your first sort of couple of years like, couple of months like? What? Talk us through it.
First couple of months was, you know, it's a culture shock, isn't it? And I think I look back on it now, you know, another thing that I sort of almost like think is not a negative, it doesn't do you any favours, is you have like 4 years as an army cadet, you think you are the dog's bollocks, and you've really, really got to sort of relearn everything and get that out of your head when you turn up and join the army. PWR, it's got some great history. It's the oldest line, regiment of the line, bar the sort of the guards. And we've actually got a link to your lot as well. So we do like exchanges, officers and colour sergeants and that swap out with the Royal Marines. There's normally one or two floating around either way. It was really good. And then, I did 3 years, and then I did the sort of typical young squaddy thing and married the first serious girlfriend that come along. I did 12 years in total, but I did 12 years split between sort of bouncing between regular to start, then into the TA, and then discovering what used to be called like an S type. So you could just bugger off back into the regs for a year or however long. But yeah, so I did the classic, I think I'll leave the army for a woman, and then change my mind
pretty quickly, and then quickly, back in there.
Well, there's a reason why she's nicknamed wife number one.
Nicknamed and official title, by the sound
of it. Like every good soldier, you know, every good operation deserves a rehearsal. So
this is true.
get it right the second time. But yeah, she was a bit put out. I left. I was getting smashed by her and my mum. They both were sort of anti the army, and I left straight into the TA under the same cap badge. And I think it might have been a month later that I put my hand up and said, I'll go to Kabul. Couldn't have been a month. Because that was 2003, so I got out before then. But either way, I was away. I think I was abroad. I think it might have been when I went to Romania or something like that. But within a month, I was gone. And then again and again, it's, oh, we need someone to go down to Brecon and sort of help play enemy for like 6 weeks. Oh yeah, I'll go do that. That sounds good. I had a civvy job where the boss was ex-Queen's Regiment, which is one of the forebears of the PWRR, and he was living vicariously through anything that I could get up to. And then the tour, the first tour I put my hand up, I think that was the last straw, and basically she said I was going away more as a part-time soldier than I had been as a full-time soldier, so... But that wasn't going to stop me. So it was, yeah, she became wife number one. So
yeah, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back, as they say. So you did most of your tours as a, or TA or reservist, was it, in the end?
Yeah.
Awesome. And what was your sort of roles like? How many tours did you do? You said Kabul, so that's obviously Afghanistan. Did you do Iraq? Did you do...
No, I didn't do Iraq, so I left where I was for about 4 years and went off and did something else. So I was messing around somewhere else for a bit. And then my last tour, I found out that all my mates and that were going on Herrick 6. And like a lot of people sort of my age, I remember watching the paras in Sangin on Herrick 4. It was all over YouTube and the TV and that. And then where I was, they weren't going out for... Well, it was nothing on the cards at the time. And there was a composite company going of regulars, reservists and TA across PWRR and like Royal Anglians cap badges going out for Herrick 6. And my best mate who I went to Kabul with, the best man at his wedding and that, was going. And I was like, I think I'll have some of that. So, when I spoke to my boss, went back to my old unit and went out on Herrick 6. And that was my last tour and the most kinetic or exciting.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. Yeah, I think it's always one of those things of missed opportunities maybe, and it sounds like you managed to almost get it in there, which I'm sure there's lots of memories that you're glad you got, and there's probably lots of memories that you wish you never got, but... You know, decisions are decisions, and it happened, and it's made you where you are today. So when did you, without going into too many war stories and things, because this is more about trying to highlight what you're doing now, really, so it gives a good background. When did you decide to leave the army? And obviously, you're a reservist. When did you make that transition into, you know, where you are now? And what are you doing now? I realise I know, but... The listeners don't.
No, so towards the day job. Yeah. Towards the end of Herrick 6, I mean, I loved it. I mean, you know, yes, there's a few memories attached to that that are not as pleasant, and there's a few friends that didn't come home, but I think most of us sign up to do the job that we signed up to do and want to at least sort of have a crack at it and see if we're capable. And Herrick 6 sort of delivered in spades, probably almost a little bit too much. But towards the end, I remember being in a Sanger, and they don't even exist anymore, but it was piles of lads mags on the side, you know, like FHM, Maxim, Nuts, Zoo. And as a bloke sort of coming towards the end of 7 months, I just about had my fill of lads mags, and people might laugh, but I genuinely wanted something to read. So I'm flicking through this pile of magazines, and there was a magazine called Trail, which is like an outdoor magazine in the UK. So I'm flicking through that, and I'd got into the mountains a few years before when I was running around Brecon for a time and getting fit and stuff. And so I'd already sort of embraced the mountains, really enjoyed it. But I've come across this article, literally opened it, said, so you want to be a mountain leader? I was like, oh, that thing. And I know it's a thing in your former life, but yeah, you know, didn't realise there was like this civvy qualification where I get paid to go out and do adventurous stuff. So I read the article, sort of tucked that away in the back of my head. And then when I come home, I had a burning desire to go and do Everest Base Camp before I was 30. And 12 years, you know, I'd sort of earned like a half a pension between been doing the S-types and bits and pieces. It just seemed like the right age to sort of step away and actually focus on a civilian career rather than just bouncing between attachments and secondments and whatever. I thought, yeah, 30 is time I sort of grow up slightly. So, yeah, the day job, I applied for everything with a uniform and a pension, thinking I'd fit in well. You'll laugh because I know what you do for a day job, but my wife still says that she wished I'd become a fireman because I might not have the extra ballast.
Everyone says that, mate. Everyone says that. I just went through my life picking the sexiest careers, trying to compensate for my grid. That's what it is.
I think you lot get a bit more time to negate the ballast that's crept up on me in my 40s. So, but I applied for all the emergency services and the police wrote back first, and I just went, yeah, all right, that'll do. And just cracked on with that. And then in the background, obviously I was going off to Everest Base Camp, and that's where we come up with this idea about Mad Dog Adventures.
Awesome. Would you say that Everest Base Camp trip, was that the sort of foundation of Mad Dog Adventures? Is that where it was sort of born? Or was it a bit more of a slow burner?
No, definitely. I mean, Everest Base Camp, that was where the idea, I think we even had the name before we come back from the end of the trip. I'm not 100% sure on that, but there was four of us that went out. So it was myself, my best friend Chris, who's one of the three that owns Mad Dog Adventures. He's a civvy, never served, went to school with him, and sort of have dragged him along on every adventure going. So when I decided I wanted to get really fit for a particular course in the military and was running around Brecon and that, poor old Chris was getting dragged up Penny Fan with me. So that's where his love of the mountains come from. And then we had two ex-para lads that we knew were with us. There was four of us, and it's completely unsupported. We decided we were going to raise money for Health Heroes, which is quite a new charity then. And being sort of three of us being like the military mindset, we're like, well, we're not paying for a guide and we're not paying for a porter and we'll carry around packs and
no cuff too tough and all that.
Yeah. And sort of wing it. And if I could go back, I probably would get a porter, because carrying a 40, 45 pound pack in the Himalayas when you've never been there before is actually really quite hard. And
is it?
You know, you're just like, altitude, what's altitude? So, yeah, and I remember walking along sort of feeling like this on my walking pole, sort of head down on them, which I'm so glad I took them, because, again, they were like walking poles for old grannies. And
yeah, it's beef, isn't it? It's beef to have walking poles.
And my wife, she's wife number two, she bought me some walking poles just before I went out, and so I sort of took them to appease her. And, like, you know, 2 days in, I'm looking at my mate going, oh, my God, these are amazing.
Yeah, your knees are going, thank God they're here.
But it was the fact that we did it. So the fact that we did it, we sort of sat in a tent and we're like, okay, so we're completely self-supported. You know, some people said that we were a bit stupid. We've planned it, all the admin, and that we've done this exped. And we were sat in a tent, me and Chris, about a day short of base camp. And basically we were both, on the way back down, we were discussing, we were going to go home and propose to our respective girlfriends. And we'd turned 30 before we went out to Everest Base Camp. So we're both sort of having that, oh, better grow up a little bit moment. But we didn't want to give up on our stupid adventures and trips. So we're like, how could we carry on doing this? And then it was like, well, hang on a minute. If we've done this, you know, and people pay people to take them to Everest Base Camp, and I'd got it in my head about this mountain leader idea. So that was it. We were like, well, if we make it a business, we can legitimately tell our wives that we're going to work.
Yeah.
and anything that we want to do, no matter how stupid, is just staff training.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that was it. I mean, it when you said about earlier about slow burner, it was a slow burner to get set up because, you know, life gets in the way. We've both gone home and proposed, and then, you know, you're buying houses and, you know, other bits and pieces and children come along. But no, certainly that was the idea, and that was it.
That was really the birth of it. What about the so for people that don't know, the symbolism or the logo is pretty cool. It's like a bear print. I'll explain it just because some people will be listening to this audio. So it's a bear print, and then below that across axe with a like ice axe. So it's like a bushcrafty sort of axe, isn't it? A traditional sort of axe crossed with a like a climbing pickaxe. Was that all decided on the day or on that trip, or is that something that sort of formulated later, or is that just, you know, same about the Mad Dog Adventures itself, the name? Is that something that you just decided and then built the imagery around it? How did the name and the branding come about?
So the name first is like, so Chris's nickname for years in my sort of family has been Mad Dog, and he literally is, he's like an adopted brother. And my mum coined the phrase once when we were on holiday when I was getting married to wife number one, actually, and he just is a bit of a handful. He's a social hand grenade, let's put it that way. he's not generally fit for public consumption, and she just turned around and went, he's like a mad dog, that boy. And it stuck. And then later on, I met Adele, my wife, who's into sort of dog sledding and the outdoors, and she had an Alaskan Malamute, which is the closest pedigree breed to a wolf. And that was a crazy dog. So you've sort of got these two sort of, got Chris's mad dog. I've now owned a mad dog. And just when you touched on the logo, it's not a bear paw, it's a wolf paw.
Oh, is it? There you go.
Yeah, so it's a wolf paw. So
there you go. I need to go back to tracking school.
Yes. So I think it's got one less, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't have a fun, does it?
That's it.
Yeah. Now I've just looked at it again. You are right. I can only apologise, and I'll thrash myself later.
That's good. So, we had the name, and then it's trying to think of something that fit. And what it was, I had a really old patch. I can't remember what company it came from. And it had a Roman gladius crossed with an ice axe. I really liked it, you know, when I was still serving, as I was getting to the mountains, I thought, oh, you know, that's like the warrior and the mountaineer. And so that was sort of like the inspiration. The wolf paw obviously come from like the name and the dog and the wolves themselves, you know, there's, I think it's been debunked, but there used to be this like picture of like a pack of wolves and the text underneath would always say, like, the ones at the front are the sick, lame and lazy, the slow, the old, and the alpha is actually at the back, sort of protecting the pack. And there's always been this sort of idea that the wolf pack really is a team effort. So we thought that really fit well with our ethos, if you like, you know, sort of that team and looking after each other. And then, yeah, the two tools, they represent the two sides of our business, the sort of the axe for the wilderness, the woodland, the survival skills, bushcraft as it is, although that's like a really sort of controversial term nowadays. Is it survival? Is it bushcraft? Have I whittled enough spoons? And then the ice axe for, you know, mountaineering. So it's sort of got a little bit of everything tucked into the logo. And a good friend actually designed it for us. We sort of went to him with the classic like design sketched out on a rough bit of crappy paper or a serviette. So this is sort of what we're looking at.
Yeah. And he back of a cigarette packet, as they used to say. Yeah,
he made it what it is. And we've been really lucky because we love it. But people seem to really quite identify with it.
I think it looks great. You know, I'm a big fan. It's one of those. I just wanted to bring it back up. So you mentioned about like the bushcraft thing, bushcraft versus survival, and I didn't realise. So when I grew up, bushcraft wasn't really well known. We had Ray Mears, the overgrown Boy Scout that he was, and then Bear Grylls sort of started a little bit later. So you sort of, if you're into that sort of outdoorsy stuff, military, if you like stuff, you know, they were the two sort of people you'd refer to in the mainstream media. You know, if it was bushcraft, Ray Mears would do it. If it's survival, Bear Grylls would do it. And that was always my sort of marker, if you like. So once I started doing Gibraltar Trading Company and stuff like that, it's obviously a lot of the people and things that we believe in are very outdoors based, some bushcrafty type people that we support and things like that. And it's I didn't realize how of a hot topic survival versus bushcraft is. And it's like, if you don't pick up your own like berries and whittle your own spoons and have a, you know the exact wood in your axe, you're not a bushcrafter. And you're like, who decided that? Like, is Ray Mears sitting there as the god going, hold on, no, you haven't, your spoon skills aren't good enough, you're a survivalist. And then also, if you're surviving with bushcraft, is that just survival, but you're using bushcraft? And then is it traditional bushcraft or is it new age bushcraft? And if you use a flint and steel but not a lighter, or if you use a jet lighter and then use a bow saw, like, it's like, what? Why is there a distinction? Who cares?
There's some real, real snobbery. I think there's some people that spend more time on Facebook telling people that they're not bushcrafters than they spend actually outdoors doing any themselves. And we actually say at the beginning of our courses, we don't teach bushcraft. Not the way that we see it. What we do in some circles, some people call bushcraft, but it's, I think it goes back to, I mean, I'm old enough to remember sort of like in the 80s, you had like Combat and Survival magazine and Rambo and this, something like that. And survival just became the dirty word. It was like, if you're a survivalist, you're like a, you know, what would now be called
prepper.
Yeah. And bushcraft that Ray Mears really coined was like the more socially acceptable version. So now, if you say, like, oh, I do survival, straight away people imagine that you're there with the whacking great big 10-inch Rambo knife picking your teeth and yeah, I've got a fold-away rifle tucked in my bag and that. And as you're saying, if it's bushcraft, then I've got to be making nettle tea and whittling a spoon. And I also think, well, if I'm going into the outdoors, why don't I just take a titanium spork with me?
Yeah.
How about I not whittle a spoon? Great skill. I think it's really beautiful, but that's really the craft side of that bushcraft malarkey. So, but yeah, it's quite a controversial subject. People get really worked up about it.
It really is. But I mean, at the end of the day, they both intertwine so much that if you're on either side of it and you're listening to this podcast going, no, I'm a survivalist, I can guarantee you do some bushcraft skills. And on the same side, if you are listening to this podcast going, no, I'm a bushcrafter, I guarantee you use survivalist skills. You know, at the end of the day, get outside, and if you want to put a label on it, crack on. But if not, just get outside like the rest of us and enjoy it.
Well, it's you know, and then the other words, if both of us have served, and I'm sure the Marines use the exact same term, you know, infantry, it's field craft, isn't it? You go in, you know, to look after yourself, put up a basher or a tarp, it's field craft. Well, hang on a minute. Half of what some people are calling bushcraft is also fieldcraft, is survival. You know, the skills are so interchangeable. It's sort of, I don't know why people get worked up about it, but there you go.
I think fieldcraft, maybe we're biased, is probably the best way to describe it, because it's surviving and thriving in the outdoors. It's not just thriving in the outdoors, which you would consider bushcraft, and it's not just surviving in the outdoors, which would be survival. It's surviving and thriving. It's fieldcraft. It's living, living and operating in a field environment. And by a field, you mean outside of a building. Awesome. So we've worked out who you are. We've worked out how Magdod Adventures turned up. What I want to know is why you've picked one of the worst colours in the world to be all over your branding. Why orange, mate?
It was a bit of a... So there's like a few bits to it. It was a bit of a response to some stuff, to if we're going back to like the survivalists, if you like. So there's a TV show, I don't know if you've seen it, called Alone, where they actually dump people out, don't they, in the Pacific Northwest. And in the first season, a guy who later went on to be really quite famous on YouTube called Joe Robinet. He had to tap out, like, I think it was at 3 days, because he put his big black fire steel down on what is a black beach on top of his black Gore-Tex jacket. Sort of turned around, started his fire, come back and picked his jacket up to put on. So he's dropped his fire steel on the beach and has lost it. And he can't see it, and these black stones, and the tide's coming in and has washed his fire steel away. And he's basically sat there for like a day with a sad on, you know, spent 2 hours digging up stones with his bare hands trying to find this thing. And has had to jack it in because it's so damp there that fire by friction is just not going to be viable for long term. So you've got that key bit of equipment that, because it was black, he's lost it. And within the sort of survival prepper sort of community, and I'm not tarring them all with the same brush, but there's like a certain section of that lot that they'll have, their lighter will be coyote brown, their fire steel will be camo, it will be hung around their neck with some multicam paracord, and, you know, so on and so forth. And you're like, well, actually, if you're whipping out a lighter to start a fire, or a fire steel, which means you're definitely having a fire, are we being tactical? Are we hiding? You know, are you worried about seeing like this, like 3-inch long lighter? Is it that important that it's got to be camo because, you know, the sniper in your local woods is going to see it in your hand while you're about to start a raging inferno? Because most people mistake fire for a bonfire, don't they? So it was like a bit of a sort of, we're looking at that and all of the camo lighters and the camo fire steels and all those small real key items that are massively important. You don't want to lose those. And when you really need them, if something's gone wrong, I don't want to have lost it because I've just dropped it. So
yeah, you want it to be a bright colour.
Yeah, but, and settled on orange.
That's just reminding me of a great story. So I remember being, one of the worst thrashings I had in training was, I don't think he ever finished training in the end, but it was, we were out somewhere on a like a field exercise. And we'd just been allowed, so it must have been sort of after week 15, we'd just been allowed to use lighters, like jet lighters and things like that, or Bic lighters, to light our hexi cubes.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, you have to use the matches at the thing. As you go through, your training team decide when you can use extra aids. Once they're happy, you can use what's issued and what the basic is. And I remember one of the lads had a bright red, like, Bic lighter, or disposable lighter of some kind. And it was on the inspection, like, the next morning. It was all laid out, and he was like, right, have you got your fire lighting? And he's like, yeah, here's my lighter. And the, like, corporal lost his shit. He was like, what the fuck is that? You know, why is it bright red? Blah, blah, blah. That would be pinged a mile off. You know, why things are seen? What's red in nature? Blah, 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 blah. It's shiny as well. And the bloke was like, turned around and went, sort of a fair one, but maybe a bit cheeky, just went, oh, what should I do, staff? You know, what should I do? And he went, well, at least wrap some sniper tape around it. Anyone got any sniper tape? And then the bloke, out of reaction and tiredness and something like that, said something along the lines of, if I'm pulling out a lighter and lighting it, surely I'm fucked anyway, corporal. And it was the sort of like, there was that moment of realization where he goes, oh shit, yeah, you probably are right. Like, if you're pulling out a lighter, it's because you need fire.
Yeah.
The sniper in the woods, as you say, isn't going to see it might not see the little tiny Bic lighter in your hand and then go, oh sweet, I'm taking a shot. He's going to wait. He's going to go, oh, that bloke's about to light something. I'll wait till I've got fire so I can see if there's anyone else around and then shoot them all. So it's just funny. Yeah. And then we got thrashed and, I don't think he ever finished training, but it's a good point. So you picked on orange, and obviously when you go on your store, if people don't know, you have a website and you have a shop and you stock sort of different things. Most of them are orange.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, you know, when you have your explanation of why. Most of those tools are survival tools, or they're fieldcraft, bushcraft tools, and yeah, you are right. And also I like camo, and I get why people in that world want to have camo items. We have a lot of camo items, but it does sort of make sense that if you are in that environment, some of the key things, you want to be able to find them quite easily, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm a camo geek. you know, all the rare and weird and wonderful camos. I might have something in Tiger Stripe that turned up yesterday.
Oh, exciting.
And I, as the perk of the one ordering it for the company, mine was Tiger Stripe, and the others have got multicam and something else. Our caps that, you know, the caps that we end up doing a camo with, you know, there's this background there, and I'm not in bright orange trousers when I'm teaching. Right. But yeah, it's just the key items, and so the bits that we stop on the shop, they're all sort of critical kit that's going to be tucked away anyway. And to be honest, we picked orange because it was bright as anything. And once we've got one bit of orange, the people, as we were saying earlier about people and their opinions on Facebook, the more people sort of didn't like orange. It's like anything. It's like, well, we'll double down on it then.
Yeah, we'll lean into it.
Yeah, we'll lean into it. And it started something small. And then before you know it, it's like, oh, look at that. And it comes in orange. All right, we'll have that. but yeah, you're not going to catch me in an orange set of strides anytime soon. But no.
I got this image now that all of MDA, all three of your instructors all standing there in like bright orange jumpsuits with, I don't know, with a GTC flannel underneath, no doubt.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. I've got the flannels packed for the weekend. There may be one of those, you know, what was those things like the weird all-in-one Lycra suits that cover your head as well?
Ah, the morph suits.
Your morph suit. I need one of those in bright orange just to really wind people up, like.
Oh god, see, now this, we need to meet up because I think I've got one lying around. I'll bring it down. Amazing. Awesome. So we've covered the branding. We sort of realize you do a mixture of field craft, we'll call it, survival type courses. We know you do expeditions, but let's sort of bring it right to a bit more of a topic that happened sort of recently. How did COVID affect your operations? How many courses were you doing pre-COVID? How many were you doing afterwards? Did you have to make any changes? And, you know, have you recovered afterwards? You know, what's the obviously you mentioned that your jungle expert's been delayed, but what other impacts did COVID have to the business?
So like anybody, like the initial lockdown meant everything stopped for a while, and COVID definitely had a big effect. Pre-COVID, it was all mountain-based events, so we were guiding and we were doing some survival and exhibition work in more remote sort of sneaky little mountain spots with some woodland that we knew we wouldn't be bothered in and stuff like that. The survival and fieldcraft, as it were, courses, you've got to have private land to be running around with axes, knives and setting fire to things. And for the first sort of couple of years of the business, you'd be writing letter after letter to landowners and, you know, just getting turned down. It's really difficult. So we were probably running, I don't know, maybe anything between 5 to 8 events a year, all mountain based, pre-COVID. We then finally got a yes from a woodland in Hertfordshire, like an estate. Was all teed up to have like a big community meetup, like everybody from our Facebook group come down, 3 weekends, sort of christen the wood and that was actually planned for the weekend before the lockdown came in. So I think the 21st and 22nd, they locked us down on the 23rd. And as it happened, 2 days before that weekend, the landowner rung us up in tears. He'd had some family dramas and some issues with the land and pulled out. So we'd lost, not only had we now lost any ability to go and run mountain events because COVID hit, we've lost this woodland as well. So we're really on the back foot. But I think it was good for us in that COVID meant that we weren't disappointing a load of clients because they couldn't come out and do it anyway. So nobody sort of saw that all of a sudden we've really sort of had to take a step back here. And the veteran owned small business community really stepped in and helped us out. So we put some feelers out, a few posts on some networking groups, and that said, look, we need a woodland, the business is expanding. And randomly, it was a guy that we'd bought some hot sauce from.
All right.
I think he does, he had a hot sauce company that doesn't run anymore, and a kit company that is still going. And And bless him, he sort of got in touch and said he had a friend that was still serving that bought a small woodland, and he could maybe tee up and meet. And there was about four different people come through with my mate's got a woodland. And we went and met this couple. He's still serving. He's doing his last year this year. They've got a small wood in Kent. It's absolutely stunning. And we got on well, you know, the meet, you just know, like, you think, yeah,
When you just sort of click, don't you?
Yeah, you know, they're our sort of people, this could work. So then what COVID allowed us to do is we just decided, right, a lot of people in our space just stopped. A lot of the outdoor people, well, we can't go outdoors, so their social media just died. And we went the other way. We said, well, some of us now furloughed. There's no excuses. We've got access to the outdoors for 1 hour a day or whatever it was. We'll make an effort now to post every single day, 7 days a week, no days off. Yeah. And we just thought, you know what? Eventually, when restrictions ease, people will want to get back in the outdoors. They will value it more. And we want to be there as that face that's been still there and a constant that they go, right, well, I'm going to go and do something with those guys. And it paid off, you know. So because of COVID, we met Jody and Jordan that run Tangier Wood, which is the woodland we use, which has been amazing. We've built a great relationship there, and that's enabled us to really expand the courses we do. Our social media just went up a notch, and we sort of got a hand. We had time to sort of get a handle more. I mean, you know, social media is a bit of a steep learning curve. So we've got time to get a bit more of a handle on that. And I think in the end, we actually come out of COVID stronger. It took us nearly a year and a half, I think, to go back to the mountains. One of the things we didn't do that we changed up is because we had the woodland, we cracked on with those courses and we didn't go to the mountains. I didn't want to be seen as, just because we could, we didn't want to be that little brand from, you know, from London that drags a load of city people up to these small mountain communities that were still really struggling with their COVID numbers. Because we wanted to go back to the mountains and people think them boys are all right, you know, and it's important to us, like, these small communities don't look at us and go, you know,
what are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The hatred, yeah. Sort of thing. And we saw that during the end, you know, as things eased, you know, there's all those pictures on social media and the TV of Snowdon just absolutely
mobbed, wasn't it?
People and, no, you know, cars double parked for miles and that, and we were like, we're not being a part of that. We'll just step back and disappear into the woods and do some stuff in there.
Yeah, I think it's COVID was a weird one. You know, we were born in COVID / just before COVID. The podcast was going in and under in a different name, and the ideas were floating around, but we hadn't settled on names and things like that. But I think for most people, it was a time where it was a make or break. You know, lots of businesses failed, and they suffered and that sort of thing. But also, a lot of businesses were born, or they thrived, or they adapted to a point where they never thought they would, and they are where they are now. So it's good to hear that, you know, you adapted, you pushed through, you kept going. Because now, you know, you're in a position where you're putting on all these massive expeditions, you've got courses running, you know, more than I can keep track of. And it's great to see, you know, other veterans and other sort of military-owned people doing well, because it's one of those things, and I think it's, I've said it before on many a podcast, and I've had some hate for it before, if you like, but, you know, when I look at someone that's left the military, no matter what branch, bar the RF regiment, they're lucky to get any job, whatever branch, you know, and I see them doing stuff for themselves, you know, things that are out of the norm, things that aren't the usual career path, I think it's amazing, because you carry so many skills, whether you've done 2 years, 1 year, essentially just passed out of training, or you've done 21 years, you know, 22, 23, however many. It teaches you so many skills that are wasted if you just end up on a building site. You know, I know a lot of bootnecks that left and end up just on a building site. And it's like, you know, no disrespect to them if they enjoy it and they're happy. I'm no one to say you shouldn't do that, but I do see it as a waste of human potential. So hearing, you know, yourself that you've been able to push it to a point and keep it going is great to hear with that adaption. So the Tangier Wood then, that sort of folded in, and that's again amazing that it's another veteran owned company. But what it shows is that support from the veteran community within the UK, and that sort of veteran owned business type thing growing in the UK. So obviously it's been a massive thing in the US for a long time now. But what impact do you think that had on building your business? You know, have you lent on the network? Have you seen it grow off the past couple of years? And if you didn't have that background, would this work? Would the business model work? What do you think?
I think the business model, as in what we do, would work. But let's face it, being ex-forces, for some people that come in our courses, that are more, let's say, down the prepper survival sort of road, that's a thing to them. They really put a lot of stock in, they've been taught by somebody that was in the forces. Let's face it, I would be the first person to tell them that, well, just because you've been in the army doesn't mean that you're some sort of survival expert or anything. Far from it. You know, there's plenty of people in the army that hate going in the field. There's plenty of jobs in the army, in ADRF, whatever, that don't have to go in the field. And whereas some people have this idea that, oh, he was in the forces, he must be able to do X, Y, and Z. But it does come, you know, like I think you sort of touched on it, but it does come with some skills that are key to all of us, or some ethics or an ethos or hard, you know, sort of work ethic and a bit of initiative that, yeah, it is wasted if you go and kind of HGV driver, not knocking it, or security guard, or those classic jobs that anyone that had been in the infantry used to go and do. But definitely, our business wouldn't be where it is today without the network. So we joined, there's a Facebook networking group tied into a little company called Veteran Owned UK. So they've got one of those directories, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's free to go on the directory, but, you know, you pay extra money to have this, that, and the other. And what I've loved about it is, from the beginning, there's been no real push from the owner to pay to be on this directory. It's not the sort of thing, the directory itself doesn't really benefit our business, but the Facebook networking group that you built around it has been untouchable in realms of how useful. Ultimately, those people that stepped forward and said, I might have a wood for you, one of them, the one that came good, actually was someone, yes, we bought hot sauce off from Instagram. But the other like three or four were all from that networking group. I went to some of their like, they put on some networking events where I learned so much about social media. I didn't have a clue about social media. I knew what I wanted to do, but none of us, all three of us are sort of, we always say like, yeah, we're good outdoorsmen, but we're crap businessmen. And so the networking aspect was great to be able to get in and learn from other veterans that were better at business, good with social media, and sort of, you know, give you a little bit of a start in some of those areas. And yeah, it's definitely been massive. And then it grows. So yeah, that's one networking group. But the social media, like the reason why you and me are talking now is social media.
All through social media, yeah. We just sort of stumbled upon each other, didn't we? And both saw the whole veteran-owned thing. And I can't remember how we started talking. I think it was either you approached me or I approached you. And it was just, you see each other's content, you see each other's stuff, and you go, oh, they seem like interesting blokes. I like what they're doing, and it matches what I'm doing. And then you know, we've got the support group where we help each other out and things. And it's an interesting one, I think. And what I like about the veteran-owned business community is, on a whole, all right, there are some individuals that might disagree. On a whole, it's very supportive.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people realise that although, you know, my company and your company technically in some aspects are competitors. We both sell caps, you know, quite similar caps. So it's like, you know, if you want a camo cap, you can get a camo cap from you, or you can get a camo cap from me. You know, so technically, in that tiny aspect of both our companies, we are competitors. But essentially, it doesn't matter, because there's enough sea for all the fishes. Yeah, you know, there's so much space in the veteran community. There's so much space in every industry that you can think of. There is space. People go, don't start a bushcraft company because, or a survival company, the market's swamped. Well, yeah, it is, but there's still space. Not everyone goes outdoors. Therefore, some people could still go outdoors. Yeah. You know, not everyone buys a hat. Therefore, some people could buy a hat. So that's what I like on a whole about the veteran community is we are very supportive and we do help each other out. Obviously, there are exceptions. You know, we know a story recently of Dead Ground Attire had to change their naming because someone literally from their own regiment just jumped up, copyrighted the name and said, right, if you want it back, you can have X amount. I had a chat with him, actually. I mean, technically, he didn't have to do anything because he's got intellectual property rights in the UK that predate his copyright. So, you know, there's nothing stopping him trying to operate under that name. But, you know, I think he'd done the right thing in rebranding and he'll come back stronger, no doubt. But so there is people like that. But on a whole, it seems pretty good. And it's good to hear that it's been supportive for you. So I'm wary that we're ticking on now. We've got me talking, which, you know, usually does tick on, hence why I have a podcast. But let's quickly touch on what you've got coming up. What events have you got? How can people get involved in what next things you've got coming up for Mad Dog Adventures then?
So the big one this year, so there's been slightly less events this year because we've got a big focus on what's coming up. So we've got a jungle expedition. So it was planned back in 2019. We touched on it, you know, COVID sort of put the kibosh on the international travel. And yeah, this is the big one for us. So obviously the company was sort of born Everest Base Camp and we could have done that. We'd love to take people to Everest Base Camp one day. But there's a million and one businesses that do that, do it really well. And we would be the tiniest fish in a really big pond. And actually, I've got a friend who's a veteran that runs Everest Base Camp trips, and I would just send people to him. So we looked at what we could do that was different, and nobody was doing the jungle in a more sort of challenging format. You know, they were going to jungle sanctuaries with nice, like, curated paths to look at orangutans and this sort of thing. And we just decided, right, yeah, jungle, that is something that fits in with the survival, bushcraft, fieldcraft space. It's an expedition. Actually, on this trip, we tucked a mountain in there as well, cheekily. But it sort of hits everything that we do. And it's hard enough. It will be enjoyable enough. People will enjoy it. And they'll have a trip of a lifetime. But it's hard enough that I want it people to sort of feel like there's a challenge aspect.
I think it's one of those environments that's classically one of the most difficult to operate in or work in. And I've not seen any other company that's essentially brave enough, but also has the skill set and the ability to be able to put on a jungle expert, you know, bar obviously the massive, massive companies that no one's got any personal relationship to because they're owned by, you know, massive companies. But yeah, no, that's amazing. And how long, put a little bit of meat on the bones then, how long is the expedition? When are you planning to go? How big is it?
So we're going in October. So it's the right sort of time weather-wise. It is...
if that's possible for the jungle.
It's always wet. It's just a varying... How wet is wet? It's 11 days, and it's a bit like... this is the starter, if you like. It's the taster for people of like, right, it's an exped slash a course. This is the one where I'm going to teach people how to function in the jungle and that actually they can do it even though they're wet and sweaty and it's minging and there's things that want to kill them, with the hope that either they can then move on and do their own thing or come back to us because the year after we'll do something a bit harder. But yeah, so it's 11 days and it's 4 days in the jungle. It's in on the island of Langkawi in Malaysia. So it's four nights, so four on a wake up sort of thing under canopy. On the last day, coming up out of the canopy by summiting the highest mountain on that island, so they'll get a view over the sort of the sea, and they'll see the little chain of islands in the Andaman Seas, which is quite important. And then they get back to the hotel for a scrub up, out in the evening for a scoff. The next day, they're on a dive boat for a day of sort of snorkel and scuba. A few beers, you know, real nice chilled out sort of, yeah. Make feel like they're having a holiday after basically an ordeal in the jungle,
like a reset day.
Yeah, and then repack all the kit, jump back on the boat. One of those islands that they'd have seen from that mountaintop, we're actually taking them out to an island. It's an uninhabited island for 4 days. So for all those people that sort of watched, what was it, Bear Grylls, The Island, I thought, I could do that. Or if they're old enough to remember Shipwrecked, which was like the Hollyoaks of the survival world.
Yeah.
It was all the attractive people living on an island. But yeah, so they're then going to get 4 days on an island. So there'll be spearfishing, fishing from the sea, from the beach, sorry, bit of spearfishing, bit of foraging of the seabed, all to add in with some rice and spuds we supply and a bit of an evening barbecue on this little little bit of heaven, actually. So that's like, it's a bit of a mix. It's definitely an expedition. It's definitely a challenge. It's a course as well. You know, they're going to get taught how to navigate in the jungle, things like casualty evacuation, hammocks, your general campcraft and fieldcraft. Enough so that they could do themselves a nice diet version of a tropical expedition themselves, a little trip, and they're not too worried about it. But also mixed in with some elements of like a bit of a trip of a lifetime. And if they're really, really keen, at the end, there's an option for us to dump them on another island for 2 days with a med kit, a praying, a satellite phone.
And really go for the full old test.
And wow. Really go for it. So yeah, anyone that gobs off that they're amazing, they're awesome, and they've got this in the bag, might find themselves dumped on like another little island. So, but yeah.
Amazing. And you've got a couple of spots still left on that, have you?
Got two, yeah. So we've limited it to 10. Because what I don't want is, I don't see the point in saying to people, oh, we're going to take you to this like pristine jungle, and then we're going to take you to this uninhabited island, and then we're going to try and fill it with 20 people. I want it to be like a really small group that comes together as a team. And because one of the things that runs throughout all our events, whether we're in the mountains or in the woods, is we're ramming it home that actually an expedition skill is teamwork in itself, is being able to get on with, same in the forces, being able to get on with people from a different background that maybe you wouldn't normally get on with. But you know what? For the greater good, for the mission, the expedition goals, whatever, you've got to get on and you've got to work together.
Bringing that whole wolf pack into it again, isn't it? Yeah. Circling back to that. Yeah.
So and if you've got too big a group, people form cliques. So it's 10 clients, 4 instructors. So it's a really nice, small, tight ratio because I want everybody to really learn from it. We've got 2 spots left. So hopefully try and fill those before we go. But it'll be great.
Awesome. And so how do people find out more about the Jungle Exped, which 2 spaces still left on coming up in October? How do they find you as a brand? How do they buy stuff from you that's orange?
Yeah, all your orange goods. So the website is www.maddogadventures.co.uk for all the orange bits and bobs. It's got all of our events on there. So UK-based mountain trips, woodland stuff. And obviously the jungle and the expedition stuff sort of all fits into that sort of overall syllabus going towards things like the jungle and bigger trips. And then social media, we're Mad Dog Adventures on Facebook, and if people want to put in on Facebook Mad Dogs Wolf Pack, we've got a Facebook group which has been lovely to see that grow into a little community of itself that sort of bubbles away and runs itself, with people sort of looking for advice on kit and teaming up to go on trips together and stuff like that. It's been really nice. And then Instagram, we're at Mad Dog Adventures, and probably the most active, I would say, on either the Facebook group or Instagram.
Wonderful. Well, that's awesome, mate. I think as soon as you get back from the jungle, obviously we're trying to plan a sort of community-based thing anyway, hopefully down at Tangier Wood at some point in the summer, because I don't like getting out in the cold anymore. So hopefully I'll see you then, and maybe we'll do an out in the wild like update on the podcast. But if not, we'll make sure we get you back on after the exped and we can have a chat and maybe bring some of the other guys along as well, and hopefully we can do it in person, which would be amazing.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Yeah. I think we need a podcast round the fire. Let's
yes,
sorted.
Definitely, that sounds amazing. Well, thank you very much, Mark. Before we sign off, remember, if you're interested in anything that Mad Dog Adventures do, follow those things. I'll also put links in the descriptions of wherever you're listening this from, and get signed up to that jungle adventure. Thank you very much for your time, and I'll see you next time.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the GTC podcast. Remember, do something that makes you just a little bit better every single day. Don't forget to head over to our Instagram at GTC Podcast. Thanks again. Stay wavy.